We're back on the Fan Morning Show. It's 4759 The Fan.
I've got some support in the text line here. Finally.
Giggles here. I can't go through the text line.
Finally, some support. It's a beacon, not a beam. Yeah, a beam implies that it is a piece of wood or metal. A beacon is, by definition, fire or light set up in a high or prominent position as a warning, signal, or celebration.
Take it up with the Sacramento Kings marketing department.
They have a beacon.
A beacon of information and truth and hope on our morning show.
Hope?
Hope for content and for maybe spicy takes he dumps on here and we go viral. Frank Saravelli, Daily Faceoff. How's it going, buddy?
Pretty good, yeah. I'm down with the first two. I don't know about the hope part, but sure. Hey, it's Monday. Let's start our week off with a bang.
Let's start our week off with a bang. I mean, this is kind of from last week, so, you know, maybe we're, you know, keeping the bang going from the end of the week to the start of the week. But you had a article on Daily Faceoff on the Maple Leafs last week with six potential trades to replace Jake Muzzin. And John Klingberg is the top name there. I want to go through the list a little bit, but let's start there. Does he make the most sense by that ranking, or he's just the highest profile guy?
Well, he's not only the highest profile guy, but I think he makes the most sense because I think he's the best all-around defenseman that's likely to be available come March 3rd. I mean, he's someone that is an above-average defender, a great skater, has some size and reach, and also really effective on the power play and has a certain skill set there that could be really beneficial to this team that I think if you're looking for someone to potentially replace Morgan Riley right off the hop, there's a lot of reasons why John Klingberg works, and he was brought into Anaheim basically specifically for this reason to be a flippable asset. And yes, his no trade clause runs through January 1st, but I thought the Leafs have a real opportunity here to jump the market. Now, I've gotten a lot of pushback from people, especially fans on social media, saying the Leafs don't need a defenseman. They need a forward. Don't you look at this team and say, hey, their scoring depth is really lacking this year. Look at their bottom six. I mean, it's a fundamental question to be asked, I guess. But on a team that's structured in the way that this one is with so many high-priced forwards, I don't know how you could possibly make the argument that this defense core, as it's currently constituted on paper, is one that makes you a Stanley Cup contender once the game starts for real.
Yeah, I think we're sort of, you know, for more reasons than one, we're in the same position that we were in last year already, where it's like, yeah, they need some help on defense, but yeah, they could probably use another scoring forward. And they're also, hey, maybe they're second in the division and maybe the ceiling is second because guess what? There's another team that's absolutely dominating right now, and that's the Boston Bruins. But quickly back to Klingberg, because these things can, I mean, you could potentially get both if you really, use up the Muzzin money. Maybe there's another deal. There's a possibility that the Leafs could fill up two buckets. But when it comes to Klingberg, maybe this strategy for him signing that one-year deal with Anaheim didn't work out perfectly because it hasn't been necessarily a great season for him. Or I guess it hasn't worked out perfectly for the Anaheim Ducks because it hasn't necessarily been a great season for him to this point. But do you get any sense of what the asking price may be for Klingberg? Like, they're probably going to be willing to take off 50%. He's probably going to be discounted in that way. Like, what would Anaheim really want from this investment as a return in the trade market?
Well, there's no question that the Ducks would be willing to utilize their cap space and retain 50%. And if the Leafs were really hungry to add more than just a defenseman, well, then you could run his contract through a second team and chop it twice and be in a spot where they can basically get him for 25% on the cap hit and then be able to add a forward using the Jake Muzzin money still. And that might be the smartest approach, but in terms of price, like even if they're retaining 50%, I think already you're looking at a first round pick plus something. So I think he's going to end up being the premier defenseman available, given really that's part of the exercise too, is to recognize how thin this defense market is you know, you heard Pierre Dorion groveling about it last week after the GM meeting, saying how incredibly difficult it is to trade for a defenseman. But, you know, the Leafs, that was the other part of this, was to point out that, yes, Kyle Dubas has made it a point to say, you know, we're not really interested in rentals, but they may have to go against that trend this year, because that's really all that's available is any defenseman that has some term that is any, you know, modicum of better than average or good in this league, teams have locked those guys up and thrown away the key. Like, they're not interested in moving them. So it's going to be hard to trade for someone that has term that really is going to be making an impact. And I'd say you probably throw that theory out the window anyway this year, don't you? Like, this is a burn the boats type of year. Like, you're not worried about next year, the year after, especially if you're in Kyle Dubas' spot. You're just saying, we got to win. We got to get over the hump this year, and we're not going to leave any stone unturned.
Yeah, that's what I kind of wanted to ask you next, because with the exception of Matt Roy, all the players that you listed, and anyone listening should take or go check out the article, everyone you have listed except Matt Roy is an expiring asset. And I wondered if that was more who's available versus, like, how big the Leafs are willing to go. But you think the Leafs would, if the opportunity was there, go pretty big if that was the best way to solve this problem?
I don't think they have a choice. I mean, what are you saving up for? Like, if you can't win with this core in its absolute prime, when do you plan on doing it? And how many kicks at the can are you going to give this group as it's constituted before you make major wholesale changes and shake up the dynamic that's, you know, been at the top of the salary cap chart and has largely prevented them from better balancing the roster? I don't know how you have a choice to do it any differently.
Yeah, and the situation kind of necessitates that, right? Like I mentioned off the top, yeah, they've kind of settled things down here. They look like the team that's going to play really good hockey, but they look second best in the division. And guess who's third best in the division? It's the Tampa Bay Lightning. So they're in a pretty tough spot already, and it seems like it's going to take something drastic maybe to change all that or at least change the outcome in the postseason.
Yeah, and, you know, I wanted to give some thought to this too, and Ailish, I want you to chime in on this. Because I was really thinking about it over the weekend as I was working through some of the responses that I was getting from fans. And they were saying, well, look how hard this team plays, their forwards play defensively. They don't need a defenseman. And I was thinking, what if the reason why the forwards play so hard defensively is because they know that they have to because this defense core can't help itself?
100%.
That they actually need to put in 150% with their back pressure out of necessity, because it's not a defense core that, at, you know, more often than not can stand on its own 2 feet.
I
wonder how much their game might change if you have some efficient puck movers back there that can kill plays and get you out of trouble.
I certainly think there's a lot of validity to that. Like, in my short time of playing in that sport as well, not at that high level, but you change the makeup of your game knowing the strong suits and the weaknesses of your roster. Even if it's let's say it's the goaltending situation, you don't think you tighten up on defense if you have your third or fourth stringer in net. Like, it's a conscious thing or even a subconscious thing where you're playing differently because you know that there's a weakness in your roster. So that could certainly be it. I'm not 100% sure of how much it, you know, resonates at the top level, but I think you're certainly bringing up an important part there.
There are also the realities of, like, who wins in this league. It's really talented defensive teams. And that's, you know, some of that is the forward group. We've seen Ryan O'Reilly star and lead his team to a Stanley Cup, but there's also a Petro on that team. Like, you generally need those studs because it can't all fall on defensive prowess from the forward standpoint.
That's right. Frank, I want to ask you about a tweet that you brought up here. Ville Heinola for Nick Robertson. I know you kind of put it out there as like a who says no type thing, but it made me think about just Nick Robertson's time right now and what he has and hasn't done for this roster. And I think there's a lot of debate online. It's like, should he just be playing in the AHL to get minutes and reps? If he's not playing anywhere, how is this helping with his progression? Is he not an upgrade on the bottom six that the Leafs have already? Like, what do you think is going to happen with the next couple weeks? And I also hear the noise that we're giving this guy too much. Like, he's still young. He's still going to have a successful career. But wouldn't we want to see him somewhere playing to help with that successful career get started?
Well, let me start from the back end of those questions and work my way up. Like, should he be in this lineup? Wouldn't he be helping this team? If the coaching staff thought that he would be in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact of the matter is he's playing behind Dennis Malgin at this point.
Yeah.
And isn't getting that opportunity. And the Leafs aren't doing that because, you know, they're trying to develop him or teach him the right way. This isn't a developmental league. This is we put our lineup in to win. We're playing for keeps.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they thought that he could be a difference maker, he would be playing. And it's funny, but not funny to see the response, on social media. Cause I think about it like, you know, just throwing that sort of, hey, I just woke up and this was floating in my brain. And I was like, this is the mm-hmm. perfect day, a Friday, to throw it out there and have a little fun. Is that I think fan bases view their prospects by and large the same way that minor hockey parents view their own player. Like, damn, this kid is good. And like, you don't have any larger sense of like awareness of what the universe is like. Like, and I'm not slagging or knocking Nick Robertson at all. Like, he could turn out to be a good player. He could pop somewhere given the opportunity. And I don't know, become a successful bottom six player. He could. He's got some of the skill set and certainly has the shot. But I mean, the thing is, like, teams aren't in a position of, you know, not utilizing those skill sets if they can, if they have an alternative. If that makes any sense, like, if he was moving the needle, he'd be playing. And so I just feel like teams and fan bases specifically really overvalue what they have in front of them and don't see the larger, you know, sort of universe out there. And I think, you know, it's interesting from a Jets perspective because both fan bases were like cranky, saying like, why would we trade our guy who's so good and such a prized prospect for that guy who stinks? And like the other fan base is yelling at the other, I don't know. It was an interesting study in social media yet again, but I just look at it and I say he's got some really intriguing parts of his game and he's got a lot of other parts that need a lot of work. And that's why I liked the sort of proposal, was because both guys clearly have some upside. Both guys could be something, but right now aren't and haven't been able to break through. And oh, by the way, Ville Heinola has more points in one fewer career NHL game than Nick Robertson. So, and he's a defenseman. So it goes to show you, like, you know, beauty sometimes is in the eye of the beholder and you never really know.
Yeah. I think you have the right read on Robertson right now in that it's like, he was one of the few prospects from a short time period that actually came up. And he was advertises, oh, this is a first round pick that just came in the second round. And I think that's part of the discussion behind him. And that's part of, you know, the
thing. If his last name was Smith, or if his brother wasn't having a starring role for the Dallas Stars.
Or if he wasn't a Toronto Maple Leaf, Frank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's, you hit the nail on the head. We're probably not spending nearly as much time talking about it.
Yeah. And right now he's pretty pigeonholed in what he is. He's a second line left winger who can't make that. You know, he can't fill that role right now for the Leafs. So how valuable is that player really on the open market? I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, probably the answer is probably not that value. Like, if you're going to move him, it's going to be as part of a package where someone takes a flyer on him to bring in someone that's pretty good. Or it's exactly in a trade like we sort of outlined, which is for a player with a similar lot in life right now.
Okay, Frank, some other information or some other rumblings this weekend was Patrick Kane and the Bruins making a lot of sense. Some NHL execs floating that out there. Not saying that it's a potential that's here on the horizon, but just that it could be a fit. What are your thoughts on maybe Patrick Kane and when this might be a situation that we see some action, if we do at all, and if the Bruins would be someone that you would circle as a potential landing spot?
Yeah, Ailish, I think it's the Blackhawks plan to begin having those types of conversations and initiate those conversations with not just Patrick Kane, but also Jonathan Toews, who share the same agent, once the calendar turns over to December. That's when things really kind of begin to heat up. You begin to get a better sense of which teams are in the mix, which teams aren't in terms of the playoffs, potential fits and destinations, you know, and also needs. And I think need is the key. Would Patrick Kane look good in that lineup? Of course he would. You know, he'd look good in any lineup as an addition. But I'll say this. I believe the Bruins, when it's all said and done, are more in line for a center than a winger. And I say that you might be surprised because they have Patrice Bergeron, really one of the best of his generation, and then followed closely by David Krejci, who came back. But it's not just for this year that I think the Bruins are looking to add a center. Yeah, it'd be great to strengthen and add a really good third one to your mix. But they need someone that's going to be able to carry the flag for them moving forward, because Patrice Bergeron was, you know, sort of a, it took him a while to decide and officially sign. And David Krejci, of course, as you know, had to come back over from overseas. And so they're in a spot where who's the next guy? And I think that's going to be one of their key focuses, is not just to make this team better for this deadline, but who's going to be able to play center for the Boston Bruins for the next 5 to 7 years.
Who does make the most sense for Kane right now?
That's a good question. I can tell you, and one of the teams that, and this is another reaction that's really funny to get on social media, I really believe the New York Rangers would be a fantastic fit. And I think the Rangers are intrigued about the idea of putting Kane and Panarin back together. And the reaction from fans on social media was like, we can't trade for Kane. We can't afford him. There's no chance. And it's like, I'm not the salary cap guru here. I only report on what I'm told. And I know for 100% fact that the New York Rangers, sitting at their draft table in Montreal back in July, were saying, this is the guy, late June, this is the guy that we're targeting. This is the guy we'd love to be able to pull off a trade for. So perhaps that's some dated info now, but I think it helps set the table for what may come. And I think when you look at Patrick Kane, there's so many reasons why it's a stylistic fit. It could be a potential long-term fit as well. And you look at this Rangers team right now that has had entered the year with some significant expectations, sitting in fourth place in the Metro, 9-6-4, not bad, not great, that I think they could use a little bit of a shot in the arm too.
Yeah, that might be the only thing. If Patrick Kane's truly sitting back and analyzing, you know, what the best teams are out there, and he can call his shot, maybe he just doesn't believe the Rangers are going to be in a position where they're guaranteed to at least have a, you know, an encouraging path through the postseason, let alone make it there. I think they will be there, but I guess there's no certainty, at least when compared to a team like the Boston Bruins.
It's the NHL, Justin. There's no certainty anyway. Like, I don't. You could pick the Lightning. You could pick the Bruins. Like, which team are you going to? Colorado? I mean, where are you going where you have a guaranteed path? I'd say the Rangers over the next 5 years have as good a chance as anyone.
I definitely agree with that. But if you're talking about this year, if you wanted to make the most of a 1 year, Boston, Colorado, Vegas, that might be your automatic. But again, he maybe doesn't want the easy route. Maybe he wants to hang out with Artemi Panarin again. That would be very, very cool to see. Just one more for you here, Frank. Actually, maybe a couple more for you. But one more that's kind of top of mind is, you know, I'm seeing Connor McDavid have another incredible season. I'm seeing him maybe put himself in a pole position for the Rocket Richard and not let go of that. But it seems a little bit different this year compared to last year, in that last year was like, you look around the league and there was no shortage of unbelievable performances, like Shesterkin in goal, Makar on the back end, McDavid and a bunch of other 120-point scorers. This year, it seems like it's only McDavid having a truly, truly, truly remarkable season, not to mention Auston Matthews scoring 60 goals last year. Is there anything else that's really special in the works that we're not paying enough attention to?
Yeah, Erik Karlsson just said, hold my beer. Like, I mean, seriously, the season that Erik Karlsson has had, he entered the weekend second only to Connor McDavid in points.
Mm-hmm.
And has turned back the clock in such a major way, playing humongous minutes, putting up points, four-point games left and right. He's been unbelievable. I don't think we've paid enough attention to Jason Robertson, speaking of the Robertson connection and the season that he's had. I think it's been out of this world good, on pace for, I think last time I checked, it was like 55 goals to take a big step forward. And you're right, maybe there hasn't been the sort of eye-popping seasons from so many guys, but I'm wondering what the reason for that is, and I view that as the perfect segue to ask the question. At what point are you alarmed by the season that Austin Matthews is having?
I don't think we're... I think it's definitely top of mind. It's a little curious. I don't think we're freaking out yet. I think...
This is so unlike Toronto, by the way.
He gets the benefit of the doubt, though. There's something different about Matthews when compared to the other three and everybody else on the team, where he gets a bit of a pass. It is interesting, though, that he doesn't look even remotely close in terms of, like, the threat level from game to game.
And we've had goaltending, defensemen, we've had a lot of things top of mind, like, that have taken a little bit of that space. And now, actually, we talked about it at the top of the show, like, the Leafs have kind of settled now into a comfortability of, okay, they're getting points, things are leveling out, but maybe that's when the attention starts to turn on Matthews' 5-on-5 goal production and why that hasn't been a bigger conversation point. But I think we've been a little bit distracted with other things, but that's saying a lot because there was a lot going on here.
But you're right, it hasn't been the same, Frank. So what do you see as different?
I think you hit it right on the head as the threat factor for me. Like, what was so scary about his tear through the league last year was that the confidence level with which he scored goals was insane. Like, it wasn't like a question. It was like, he's scoring tonight. Like you could, I'm sure Ailish quite literally bet on it. Like, you could bet on it that he would be doing it.
Why me, because, Frank?
you're really good at it, I think. I don't know. I'm guessing. But like, that was the thing watching him, that it was like, you knew he was going to score. He knew he was going to score. The entire building knew he was going to score. The whole league knew he was going to score. And now it was the ease in which he did it too. Like, it was like, off his stick in such a hurry, and there was so much power, not in just the shot, but in really the way he moved through the zone, that I'm just not seeing the same thing this year, and I can't quite put my finger on why. But all I can do is look at the math, and after tonight, the Leafs will have played 24% of the season, and Austin Matthews will have been on pace for... provided that he doesn't score tonight, he'll be on pace for 34 goals.
Well, there's still
34 having 34 goals seems unfathomable after last season. And I cannot believe for the life of me that in this market, I'm not trying to stir the pot. I'm just saying that I can't believe that it's not a bigger talking point. Everyone just kind of shrugs and assumes that he'll get there and that he'll go on some incredible tear where he scores like 20 in 15 games. But what if he doesn't?
Well, it's definitely possible, because last year, I mean, at this time, if you give him the pace, it was probably around 34, maybe less, but he actually had an excuse, which that he was coming off off-season wrist surgery and things didn't start particularly well for him last year. So I guess he's still got the runway. I guess he's still got the opportunity, because he did score at a ridiculous pace for the final, you know, 4 or 5 months of the season last year. But I feel like part of it is that not everything is as settled. Like, it's not working as smoothly from the entire lineup perspective. Like, he's had different line mates. He's had the different running mate. He's gone from Marner to Nylander back to Marner now. Michael Bunting hasn't been very, very good. So it just feels like things are a little bit less, maybe a little more unsettled, a little less consistent. But you're right. I think from an individual level, what it looks like, I feel like he's taking less shots. He's in dangerous positions on fewer occasions from game to game. It does seem like something's different, and that might be the opponent being a little bit more wise to it. It could be, you know, maybe a little bit of a disconnect with the lineup, but I think they do have time to sort it out. And I guess, contrary to everybody else, Leaf fans are willing to give him that grace.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I'm just doing a look at the quick math. And last year through 20 games, he had 10 goals. So he was on pace for 40. Mm-hmm. This year, if he doesn't score tonight, he'll be on pace for 34. So last year, he closed with 50 goals in 53 games. And he'd have to be on some kind of tear like that in order to get to that 50-goal mark.
And maybe the reality
He's shooting a half a shot less per game so far.
Maybe the reality is that he's not a 60-goal scorer and he's going to be more of a 50-goal scorer per year, and 60 was the outlier and that 70 was kind of crazy talk. That might just be the reality.
It might be, but think about how much of a change that is to the thought process. I mean, I know it's only 10 fewer goals, but that's not like people are like, oh, can he score 70 this year?
And if you lose 10 goals...
He might be able to, but
You're just not getting those 10 goals elsewhere, too. And that exacerbates the problem, because if it's not Matthews scoring, if it's not Tavares and Nylander scoring, where are the goals coming from? I mean, we looked at that lineup, and it was 15-goal ceiling for just about everybody else, and those players are going to be lucky to get into double digits, many of them. The Pierre Engvalls, the Yarncrokes. Maybe Yarncroke will get there. He's got a couple recently. But there's not much goal scoring regardless, so it's kind of on him to score 50 if this team is going to reach its potential, which is maybe the reality that this season is.
So I want a number from you. On a scale of 1 to 10, what is your level of concern for Austin Matthews' production compared to last season?
7.2.
You're already up 7.2? Yep. I'm under 5. I'll go 4.5. I think there's still... I think the best months of his season are ahead. I'll say that.
What about you, Frank?
I'm at 6, but
right in the middle.
Growing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, with each passing game, as you're sort of waiting for him to take off, when he's not having a 2 or 3 goal outburst, you start to wonder. I'll say that.
Well, hopefully by next week the number's gone down a little bit. We'll see, Frank.
Hey, this is all I do is provide hope.
Matthew's number's got to go up for our number to go down, I guess.
You're our beam of hope, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Our beam. Frank, appreciate you joining us as always on a Monday morning. We'll chat with you next week.
Thank you, guys. Have a great week.
Frank Saravelli of Daily Faceoff.
So good Matthew stuff. The Robertson stuff, I think, is interesting, too, because we talk about what he is and if he's only one thing, how valuable he is. Maybe, and we've been saying this a lot, maybe it's time to find out if he can play on a third line or fourth line.
I just thought it was interesting seeing Shane Wright get sent down to the AHL yesterday.
Well, that's just...
It's a whole other story, but he was not doing well with the Kraken.
It seems like they always planned this all along, though.
Right.
Because the 5-game scratch allows him to go to the AHL rather than the OHL.
It's just so disappointing, though.
I just don't like how they're handling it. Like, why? He's missed so many important years of development. Just go to the O. You don't have to play right away. You're actually having a great season. Mm-hmm. Just, like, this is the one black marker in the season. The one stain
I do think
is how they're dealing
they're
with
fumbling
Shane Wright.
It a bit.
But I guess they want him to play in the AHL rather than the NHL or the OHL. And I guess if that's their prerogative, that's what it is. But you have to embarrass
him. I had really high expectations.
You have to embarrass him to get him there.
Especially for a Kraken team that's doing well. Like,
yeah.
Anyway, it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. Yum, yum, yum. It's not 6,000 pounds of meat from Argentina, but it is a spicy rumor revolving around free agent Odell Beckham Jr. The Cowboys and the Giants have emerged as the two favorites to sign OBJ.
Oh, I wonder if this weekend changes anything for OBJ.
Two massive NFC rivals. This would be after Thanksgiving holiday. And I think the chewy, spicy part of this is...
The chewy, spicy part.
How crazy would it be if the Cowboys... If he ends up with the Cowboys, they need another receiving threat. Like, these two are also both in playoff pushes. Like, it's just... It's perfect fuel for a spicy Thanksgiving weekend.
Yeah, but one's real and one's not.
Right.
The Cowboys are real. The Giants are fake.
Well, that's where he started his career and became a star. And I guess that's interesting.
That would be a nice story. So it goes down to, like, what he prioritizes here. Does he want to win or does he want to, like, go home, be in New York, you know, be reunited with
Cowboys.
That franchise? I want him to go to the Cowboys. I want maximum, like, impact if we're talking about an in-season addition. And the Cowboys, after what they did to Minnesota in Minnesota, look like the real deal. The Eagles are sputtering here. It looks like the Cowboys have a path. I want them to get OBJ because I think it could be the most meaningful of destinations to land. OBJ's got that little, he's like that little wild card too. He made a big difference for the Rams. Mm-hmm. Not to say he's the reason the Rams have fallen off, because they've fallen off for a lot of other reasons, but I feel like he can kind of be that X factor. It'd be interesting to see how he changes things, if at all, in Dallas.
He's got to go to Dallas.
The Giants, come on. We don't need it.
Him and one of the biggest football markets in the United States, again, I like it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's just something to chew on before you chew on your Thanksgiving turkey this weekend, Americans. You might come out on a Monday morning with a new spot for him. It's supposed to happen after Thanksgiving, so.
We shall see.
We're going to take a break. We're going to do winners and losers before we set up some more World Cup action. That's next on the Fan Morning Show with Justin and Ailer, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL, the J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, Justin Cuthbert and Ailish Forfar. Beams, beacons, and winners and losers. An abbreviated version because we got Devang Desai, producer of Kick the Grass, which is every Saturday on The Fan during the World Cup and available on any platform in which you get podcasts. So we got to get through our winners and losers quickly. So let's not waste any more time. You got something?
You go.
Okay, I'll go with the winner. Got to go to the Toronto Argonauts. They specialize in championship games. Big winners. Andrew Harris, all he does is win. Pinball Clemens, all he does is win. 7-0, all time in Grey Cups. Mm-hmm. Whatever role he's in, the Toronto Argonauts are the biggest. Why do you scoff?
No, I just think
biggest
easy.
Winners of the weekend are the Toronto Argonauts. Let me hear your more difficult winners.
Oh, I have a winner. I searched this one out. The NFL. They've changed their MVP voting to.
Have they?
Yes.
Oh, that's information I need.
Exactly. This is why I work on this radio station. Instead of just picking one winner, they will be now publicly showing the selections, like the ranking, which has never been the case. So you'll be able to see where people fall in line.
Like live?
No, like they're now going to show your rankings of decisions for the MVP pick.
So just like
voters will rank their top choices for these awards instead of just picking a winner.
Oh, I didn't realize they did
then
that.
Then it gives the voters a clear picture of where players stand in the MVP race.
Okay, so we can get into the NHL sort of thing where there might be a little politicking. Let's say you're a writer in Philly and you don't think that Patrick Mahomes should win. You
especially
like Jalen Hurts. You could drop Mahomes
like
down
this,
on
like,
your list.
There's a few players that could make the case to be in the awards. You said Jalen, you said Patrick Mahomes, Tua. Like, mm-hmm. You want to know where these things fall into place? Well, you're going to see a little bit of different combinations on the ballots.
And
now.
Tua might be the interesting one, because how do you dock him? Mm-hmm. How much do you dock him for missing a couple games when, if you look at the games he's played, he's probably been the most valuable player just based on that. I'll keep in mind, or keeping in tune with NFL awards, my winners of the weekend are the Seattle Seahawks trophy hopefuls. Geno Smith, Kenneth Walker, Pete Carroll, all idle. Didn't play a game. It's their bye week, obviously. And the ones that were likely to take the awards from them, for Geno, be comeback, Kenneth Walker, Offensive Rookie of the Year, Pete Carroll, Coach of the Year, all the players that had a chance to make up ground or pull further ahead had brutal, brutal weeks. Saquon Barkley, 22 yards on 15 carries. Damian Pierce, who's the other rookie, 8 yards on 10 carries. And Kevin O'Connell, blowout loss with the Vikings. Brian Daboll, loss. Robert Saleh, loss. Nick Sirianni, I guess he survived, but the Eagles were awful in their victory over the Indianapolis Colts. So if you're Seattle and you think you're going to win a trophy this year, you might be thinking even better, and you didn't even lift a finger over the weekend. So one of my winners.
A winner that I briefly mentioned at the top of the show, Ontario, and John Torrey.
You're giving John Torrey a winner.
I think that he was part of
coming to his senses.
The city council that helped vote that we would have alcohol rules lifted to be serving at 7 a.m. for the World Cup. So technically, he's adjacent to that win.
Okay.
Ontario's a
I'll
winner.
I'll accept it.
They will be able to serve alcohol 7 a.m. moving forward throughout the World Cup. See you Wednesday at Cafe Diplomatico.
Adam Svensson is a winner.
Oh, yeah.
He becomes the 16th Canadian to win on the PGA Tour with a win at the RSM Classic. Grabs over $1 million, 2-year exemption, so more money. And will be at the Masters this year. The amazing thing, he shot a 73 in round one. So he could have just jumped in the car and headed home, headed to the next event. It's the offseason for the PGA. He could have started that offseason early, but he followed that 73 up with a 64, 62, 64 to win on the PGA Tour. Very, very cool.
My next one has two audio clips from the New York Jets, who lost 10-3 to the New England Patriots yesterday. First up here is Robert Saleh
mm-hmm.
saying, let's just play the clip first.
Coach, when you talk about the second half, especially the offense, 7 possessions, only 2 total yards.
Yeah, it was dog.
So he's asked about the offense, obviously. Mm-hmm. He says dog. And then Zach Wilson was also asked about the offense, and this was his response.
As an offense, though, I mean, when you guys are only able to score 3 points, the defense only lets up 3 points. I mean, do you feel like you let the defense down at all?
No.
They're just both losers.
Big losers. I had the Jets as losers as well. They averaged 2.77 inches per play in the second half versus the Patriots. Mm-hmm. Inches. Yeah, I think you let the defense down a little bit. That was a 3-3 game until
it's
5 seconds
bad.
Left in the fourth quarter. Unbelievably let down, the defense should feel.
Can I have one more just about...
Go for it.
NFL teams that are losers, the Texans. They rushed 16 times for 21 yards. They averaged 1.3 yards per rush.
That's my guy, Damian Pierce.
And their longest rush was how many? Just guess. Their longest rush.
4 yards.
4 yards.
Wow. That was a good guess.
This is embarrassing.
Two quick winners on the NFL side. Marcus Jones, who took back that punt for the Patriots to break that 3-3 deadlock with the Jets. 84 yards scored with 5 seconds left. Basically a walk-off punt return. But the bigger return was the kickoff return for Cordarrelle Patterson. He set an NFL record for kickoff TDs in an era. He knew the previous era before they changed the kickoff rules. But this guy's got like limited opportunities. And yet he's still... the NFL all-time leader in kickoff returns when this is basically a lost art. So shout out to those returners for making big splashes in the NFL this weekend.
I have a winner that's also a loser.
Okay.
The Canada-USA rivalry series has been played for the last couple games here, last couple days, over on the West Coast. They played a game in Seattle yesterday. They broke the attendance record for a national women's hockey game ever played in the United States with 14,000 plus fans. That's the winner. The loser is Canada. They've lost the last 3 straight consecutive games to the United States at the rivalry series. Not sure what's happening over there. They have their iconic triple crown year. They win 3 championships in 12 months, and now it looks like they're scuffling a little bit, but that's okay because this is why you play the rivalry series, to get stuff together. I know they've got some different line combinations. They've brought some new faces into the fold. Doesn't seem to be working. 3 losses in a row to the United States, but a winner for women's hockey.
That's tough. 2 more losers, one of which I have audio, and one which will give us the transition into our conversation with Devang. But Giannis Antetokounmpo is a massive, massive loser.
I had him in my loser, too.
Massive loser.
He's fake nice guy. Fake nice guy.
I think he showed himself. He showed that he's not the guy that he's been trying to project for a very, very long time. Maybe you just got him at his worst moment.
No.
But his worst moment was this. After going 4-for-15 from the line, Antetokounmpo went back to the floor to try and practice free throws.
On the road.
There was a ladder set up. I guess they were doing some work, taking down the nets, whatever they were doing.
They had to do ice conversion. Like, they had to do something.
But, and I don't mind. Like, he can go out there and do it, but just like, hey, you don't have to push the ladder over because you're upset. So he showed that he might be fake nice guy.
Not showed. He is. I'm on board with that.
We got Devang on the line, but I want to get to my last loser. It's perfect for him because I'd like to hear him react to it. And my last loser is Gianni Infantino, who is the FIFA president. He had maybe the worst State of the Union style press conference of all time. We got the sound. Can we throw to that? And then we'll bring in Devang and we'll get his take on things.
Today I feel Qatari. Today I feel Arab. Today I feel African. Today I feel gay. Today I feel disabled. Today I feel a migrant worker. And I feel this, all this, because what I've been seeing and what I've been told, since I don't read, what I see brings me back to my personal story. I am son of migrant workers. Of course, I'm not Qatari, I'm not Arab, I'm not African, I'm not gay, I'm not disabled, I'm not really a migrant worker. But I feel like them because I know what it means to be discriminated, to be bullied.
Devang, thanks for joining us. Give us your take on Gianni before we we'll throw you right into this. Give us your take on Gianni before we get to Canada and what's ahead today in the World Cup.
First off, thanks so much for that intro, Justin. Really appreciate it. I was thinking we've heard some really bad speeches since 2016, thanks to certain actors entering the world stage, and yet I think that still may be the worst speech I've heard in at least the last 10 years. Just incredible.
Yeah, it couldn't have been more tone deaf. His attempts to empathize with those who are actually marginalized was pretty weak. Anyway, let's get to the exciting things when it comes to the World Cup. And that's over the weekend. We learned that at least Alphonso Davies believes he's ready to rock. Do you expect to see him on the pitch Wednesday to start?
It's a great question. I think it's the biggest question we all have. I've been going back and forth on this, and if he's fully fit and he's told people in Qatar that he is fit, I think it makes sense for him to play against Belgium. My only issue would be that if you're looking at all three games and the probabilities of Canada getting a result out of them, Belgium might be the lowest, and if Alphonso is not 100%, do you rest him and think ahead to Croatia? But I think we've heard John Herdman say this a couple of times. It's really hard to sit someone like him if he's ready to go and saying he's ready to go. So as of Monday morning, I'm pretty confident he's going to start in that game.
What percent of the last week or 2 weeks has been a little bit of playing coy and keeping your cards close to your chest with Alphonso Davies? Or has it really been that much of a question mark for this team if he would participate on Wednesday's match?
I want to say 70%, Nailish. I think this is classic international tournament gamesmanship, and John Herdman is not the only manager doing this. That being said, I mean, we all saw him pull up injured playing with Bayern, and the videotape doesn't lie. That looked kind of dicey. So hamstrings are wonky, and everyone is different. But I'm pretty certain that John Herdman might be overplaying some aspects of his players' injuries. I'm thinking about Stefan Eustachio. I'm thinking about Milan Borjan. You would hope that this is just maybe something to plant in the seeds of the Belgians to get them off their tactical plan.
Yeah, Eustachio important there. We shouldn't forget about him because Davies has been the discussion all along. But when you threw Eustachio in the mix, it's like, okay, we're maybe missing two of our most impactful players. But that one might be more tactical than anything because, you know, if Davies is there, you're going to have to deal with Davies. But Eustachio might change a lot of what Canada would be doing, right?
Exactly. And I just matchups on Belgium, Kevin De Bruyne, maybe a top three player in the world. He will be a focal point for Canada to mark and plan around. And if you have someone like Eustachio there, I think that makes that planning all that much more smoother because he's been playing on an incredible level in Portugal for his club. So him being there is a massive, massive thing. And you're right, Justin, we talk about Fonzie all the time, but I look at Borjan and Eustachio as equally important factors for this team.
In just about 10 minutes, England will open its World Cup versus Iran. They are second among European favorites at plus 800. Do you see that for the defending European finalists as underrated or overrated?
You know, it's a weird one because if you look at England the last
couple international tournaments, they've done quite well, and quite well for England, all things considered, considering the gap that's been since they've last won the World Cup. But making the semifinals in Russia 4 years ago, and then, of course, losing in penalties to Italy in Euro 2020, they're on a good track run. I think that the problem is the manager, Gareth Southgate, I don't think is inspiring much confidence, and whether that's regarding his team selection and continuing to trust the likes of Harry Maguire or bringing someone who's a bit slow-footed and Connor Cody at the back, I think that's raising eyebrows. But I think I've been talked off the ledge a bit when it comes to England, because just on a pure talent basis, they are up there. They are loaded at each position, and they're dealing with injuries. I think we still have to give credit to the players that are there, and also give credit to Southgate in terms of what he's done at tournaments in the recent past. So I think they're weirdly underrated. I'm underrating them. I think they might not win this group, but I still like them to get through.
Well, Justin had to ask about England because he selected them, handpicked them in our little bracket of teams to cheer for this year. So he needs to, a little bit of a confidence boost. Okay, let's talk about the team south of the border from us. The U.S. opening today versus Wales. I feel like, and Justin mentioned this before as well, that expectations are kind of just like low for them, but they're in a manageable group. Like, I don't really know the pulse of what the Americans are thinking about for this World Cup, but what are your expectations for that team and what they could potentially do here at the World Cup come today?
Well, I think if you ask most American fans, they see this group as a cadre of players that will really challenge in 2026, 4 years from now, when the World Cup comes back to North America, because talent-wise, I think it's easy to see what's coming. And I look at the midfield alone that the U.S. boasts with Tyler Adams, Weston McKennie, and Yunus Musa, and it's hard to not be impressed by that. I think the issue is there is a lack of experience. They don't really have your Alphonso Davies or your Kyle Ahrens in terms of game-breakers up front to score goals. I think it'll be more about that midfield and trying not to get burned by some of the faster teams in the group, like Wales or Iran. So I like their chances solely because I really do rate that midfield. And though I'm not excited by their manager, Greg Berhalter, and this is probably his last rodeo in charge of this team, I really like the youngsters that they have at their disposal. It's just a question of, is it too soon? Probably for this tournament.
Netherlands and Senegal is the other game as well today. Senegal missing Sadio Mane. Netherlands, one of the kind of hipster picks for making a run in at this tournament. Who or what do you have circled as worth watching for in that game?
It's Netherlands being a dark horse pick does sound a bit strange, but I think if you look at it and look at the reasons why, I don't think they have that focal point that they've had in the past. There's no Robin van Persie. There's no Ruud van Nistelrooy. This is a younger Dutch team that does have a lot of intriguing pieces, but maybe no star. And like, there's the Memphis Depays, and there's people like Luke de Jong who've been around for a long time. It's just not there in terms of the young firepower that maybe we've come to expect from other nations. That being said, Cody Gakpo is impressive. Frankie de Jong is impressive. Javi Simons is impressive. They have a lot of good players that I think will make a name for themselves at this tournament. There are questions, though. I think keeper is a question for them. I think where exactly the goals are going to come from are another one. But looking at the group itself, Senegal losing Sadio Mane, Bayern Munich star, before the tournament is a massive blow for them. And I think if both teams were watching the opener on Sunday, they have to like their chances of getting out of this group if they get a result here, because I think we can safely say Qatar will probably not be in the conversation to get through. And even though Ecuador looked good, it's more of a question of how bad was Qatar as well.
Okay, I need some validation before we'll let you go, Devang. I got Netherlands -1 going into the Wake and Rake later today. You said the goals might be a little bit hard to come by, but I think they're going to win this game and maybe a free roll to get a nice plus 170 if they can win by more than one. Do you think it's a decent pick?
It's decent. I'm a bit worried for you, my friend, but it's really because Senegal is quite good defensively. I know Mane's not there, but they'll play well. They'll be set up well, but I do like the Dutch to get a result as well. So be comfortable with this pick.
I should be comfortable?
I think so.
Okay, that's all I needed. That's all I needed, Devang. Devang is producer of Kick in the Grass, which is every Saturday on The Fan. I was listening to it over the weekend. It was fantastic with Jeff Blair and Dan Riccio. Mm-hmm. And it's available anywhere you get your podcast. So during the World Cup, make sure to check out Kick in the Grass. Devang, thanks for coming on with us.
Thanks, guys.
Love it.
My Netherlands.
I kind of think we should do that like every day leading into the 8 a.m. Now we got the game on. It's like, this is all coming together here. Should we get a quick bet on this England?
Yeah, okay, so it's, what, 5 minutes away from starting? They're singing the national anthems right now on the television.
Yeah, so...
So what are the odds?
We're going to have to be quick with it. We're going to break in the second. Maybe we can discuss and then just let everyone know what we did. It might have to be a live bet for
anyone.
Okay,
well, England's minus 250 on the full-time, Iran plus 900.
What's the total?
The total is set at 2.5 is plus 130, over 2.5.
So I kind of like the under. So England just basically won 1-0 games all the way to the Euro final last year, I believe it was, because of COVID and all that. Mm-hmm. So
I can parlay you England to win and the under.
England to win the under seems like the only way England will win.
It's plus 163. It's kind of lame.
Oh, I'm playing that.
Okay, great. Never mind.
England and the under. 2-0, 1-0, both gets it done. Harry Kane, what's he, anytime scorer? Do you have that up? Jamming you up. It's probably around even money, though. Maybe plus 150? We'll get it to you after the break. We'll go to break.
Plus 250.
Plus 250?
No, anytime, plus 123. First goal scorer is
okay,
plus 250.
So plus 123. Yeah, probably won't do that. Let's go England and the under. Little show bet. We'll discuss that and more after the break. We got Ross Tucker to talk a little NFL, and then we'll do our wake and rake. So get those submissions in. It's the Fan Morning Show, Justin and Ailish.